Chapter 3. The Anti-Impact Framework. An Anti-Human Moral Goal and Standard. We ended the last chapter with a crucial question, a question that we need to answer in order to identify the right path forward on fossil fuels, including to identify the expert sources we need to identify that path. The question was, how has our knowledge system come to be so anti-energy and so dysfunctional that it engages in two irrational methods of evaluation when it should know better? These two methods are, one, to consistently support the elimination of cost-effective energy sources while ignoring their massive life-or-death benefits, and two, to consistently catastrophize the negative side effects of cost-effective energy, wildly overstating or overpredicting their magnitude and ignoring our ability to master them, especially using cost-effective energy. And a crucial aspect of this question is, why do we, our knowledge system's consumers, ourselves engage in, or at least not oppose, these irrational methods of evaluation when we should know better? If we can answer this question, we can understand the underlying causes of our knowledge systems and our own irrational methods of evaluation, take steps to correct that cause, and have a good chance at identifying a path forward on fossil fuels that will be beneficial to humanity instead of the likely mass destructive path that our unchallenged knowledge system is leading us down. Let's start with the first irrational method of evaluation. Why does our knowledge system, and to a significant extent most of us, support the elimination of fossil fuels and other forms of cost-effective energy while ignoring their massive life-or-death benefits to billions of people? As I have discussed, supporting the elimination of cost-effective energy while ignoring its benefits cannot be explained by ignorance of facts. Leaders of our knowledge system have been exposed to many facts about the value of cost-effective energy to human flourishing, and it certainly cannot be explained by pleading ignorance that this is an irrational method of evaluation. Everyone knows you should not support the elimination of something without first considering its benefits. So what can explain it? The same thing that has caused people throughout history and today to support anti-human policies even when they have the factual and methodological knowledge to know that they are supporting anti-human policies. Their primary moral goal is anti-human. The issue of one's primary moral goal is a crucial one in philosophy that we are almost never taught to think about, yet it shapes our evaluations to an almost unimaginable degree. Whenever we are evaluating what to do about something, whether fossil fuels or antibiotics or the use of animals for medical research, there is a primary moral goal at work, something that takes precedence over everything else, that serves as our primary standard of evaluation. Consider the evaluation of animal testing for medical research. Is animal testing for medical research good? Most people, including me, believe that the answer is yes. Why? Because while we have no desire to make animals suffer, we prioritize the countless lives that animal testing saves. Why? Because our primary moral goal in this context is some version of advancing human flourishing, increasing the ability of human beings to live long, healthy, fulfilling lives, not preventing animal suffering and death. That primary moral goal serves as the standard by which we evaluate animal testing for medical research as good. But note that while most people support animal testing for medical research, millions of people worldwide evaluate as immoral any kind of testing of animals. Some of these people are ignorant of the facts, but many are not. There are scientists who evaluate animal testing as immoral, even though they know it has been very beneficial to human life. Why? Because they believe that a higher moral goal and standard than saving the lives of human beings from disease is the moral goal and standard of animal equality. The basic idea of animal equality is that it is morally wrong for human beings to interfere with, and above all, kill other animals. To the extent one's primary goal is animal equality, one will be morally driven to eliminate all human impacts on animals, including human benefiting impacts such as the use of animals for medical research. The lesson here is that an anti-human goal and standard can cause people to pursue anti-human policies, even when they have the factual and methodological knowledge to know that they are pursuing anti-human policies. This lesson, I believe, explains many of the times in history when human beings, including whole knowledge systems, who should have known better, supported and enacted viciously anti-human policies, such as slavery, racism, religious dictatorship, communism, and Nazism. For example, Nazi Germany, which enjoyed widespread support by the German knowledge system, supported the extermination of Jews, not because it was unaware that extermination would kill many people, but because its goal and standard was the opposite of human flourishing, the triumph of one group of people, Aryans, and the subjugation of Jews and other non-Aryan groups. One instructive feature of anti-human goals is that they often win widespread adoption by being disguised as somehow pro-human. There are two basic means of disguising anti-human goals. One way is to falsely portray the anti-human goal or policy as pro-human via vague, misleading terminology. For example, animal equality is often advocated for by using the vague and misleading term animal welfare. Animal welfare can mean both, one, pro-human concern with the welfare of animals, such as opposition to unnecessary cruelty, which, as an animal lover, I certainly have, and two, anti-human concern with the welfare of animals, such as the animal equality opposition to testing them for medical research. Many people embrace animal welfare, thinking that they're just embracing opposition to unnecessary cruelty, but end up in practice supporting the whole animal equality agenda, including opposition to animal testing for medical research. The other means of disguising anti-human goals is to spread false pseudoscientific assumptions that make anti-human goals seem benign or pro-human. In the realm of opposing animal testing, this takes the form of the claim that animal testing is never actually valuable for research, which makes this claim seem as if there's no human cost to opposing animal testing for medical research. Racist movements often make use of the spread of false pseudoscientific assumptions, telling their followers that killing or subordinating non-preferred races is not anti-human because those other races have somehow been scientifically proven to be inferior and therefore are not truly human. Is an anti-human goal and standard, perhaps disguised through vague terminology and false pseudoscientific assumptions, at work within our knowledge systems and our support of anti-human energy elimination policies? One particularly compelling piece of evidence that this is exactly what is going on is our knowledge system's evaluation of fossil fuels' effects on the world so far. Regardless of what you believe about the impacts of rising CO2 levels on the planet's future, if you are knowledgeable about the state of the world today, you must acknowledge that more human beings are flourishing than at any point in history. And if you're at all knowledgeable about the ways fossil fuels power our world, you must recognize the use of these fuels as a major contributor to our unprecedented level of human flourishing. This positive evaluation of the world and of fossil fuels' role in it should hold, even if you believe that rising CO2 levels will lead to such negative climate impacts that they will overwhelm our fossil-fueled climate mastery abilities and the benefits of fossil fuels to every other aspect of life. Such a view would be expressed something like this. Fossil fuels have made the world a better and better place to live, including a place where we are far safer from climate. But tragically, in the future, their negative side effects will be so adverse that it's worth depriving billions of people of fossil fuels' massive benefits. That would at least be a coherent claim. But today's knowledge system, especially its designated experts, does not acknowledge this at all. Revealingly, it treats today's world, including climate, as being in a horrible state due to fossil fuels, whose benefits it portrays as having already been overwhelmed by negative side effects. It talks about how fossil fuels have destroyed our environment and destroyed our climate via the impacts of fossil fuels. For example, Antonio Guterres, head of the UN, has said, our war on nature has left the planet broken, and the consequences of our recklessness are already apparent in human suffering, including towering economic losses. And yet, factually, this planet has been afflicted by far less human suffering than ever, including far less suffering from climate, and we have experienced not towering economic losses, but unprecedented economic gains. Our knowledge system's evaluation of today's world as terrible because of fossil fuels gives us every reason to believe that its goal and standard of evaluation is not advancing human flourishing, but rather some anti-human goal and standard, likely disguised by vague, misleading terminology and/or false pseudoscientific assumptions. And if we look carefully for a common moral goal behind our knowledge system's support of energy elimination policies, that's exactly what we find. Eliminating human impact. Once we are aware of the phenomenon of anti-human goals and standards driving anti-human policies, we can be on the lookout for them. Is there a common driving goal for all the forms of energy elimination policies our knowledge system supports, such as opposition to fossil fuels, nuclear power plants, hydroelectric dams, and solar and wind projects? Absolutely there is. Observe that whether the opposition is to fossil fuels, nuclear, hydro, or solar and wind, there is always one type of reason given that points to the primary moral goal and standard at work. The reason is the significant impact the source of energy has on the rest of nature. Fossil fuels significantly impact nature with CO2. Nuclear significantly impacts nature with radiation and long-lasting waste. Hydro significantly impacts nature by interfering with free-flowing rivers. Solar and wind significantly impact nature with mass mining, large land use, and interference with myriad species. When we hear one of these arguments, that a source of energy significantly impacts nature and should therefore be opposed, it's easy to assume that the impact on nature is primarily opposed because it's bad for humans, and thus that the primary goal is to advance human flourishing. This is most plausible in the case of fossil fuels and CO2, which, even if you acknowledge has been consistently catastrophized so far, is legitimate to be concerned about going forward from a human flourishing perspective as CO2 levels rise. But observe that in all the other instances of energy opposition, there is not even the plausibility of the level of threat to our future that rising CO2 levels supposedly pose, often called an existential threat. The radiation in the case of nuclear is trivial, and the waste has been safely managed for generations. And arguing against vital hydroelectric projects in the name of free-flowing rivers, or arguing against solar projects in the name of not displacing desert tortoises, is clearly not focused on human flourishing, not when the benefit that is being destroyed is as vital as energy. The same is true for many other impacts on the rest of nature that have no clear adverse effects on humans, but are treated with moral urgency, such as changes in polar bear habitats or diversions of caribou in Alaska by oil operations. The impacts of energy projects do not remotely threaten the existence of these species. In fact, polar bear populations have been growing fast. Yet there is still a moral urgency to stop energy projects so as to not impact these species. Thus, the consistent thread in opposing the impacts of energy on the rest of nature is not that they harm human flourishing, but simply that they impact the rest of nature as such, which is considered intrinsically wrong and therefore in need of elimination. In other words, eliminating human impact, not advancing human flourishing, is the primary moral goal driving our knowledge system in the realm of energy, and, as we will see, in many other areas. Let's be clear. Eliminating human impact is an anti-human moral goal. Human beings survive and flourish by impacting nature. To live at anywhere near our current level, we need to massively transform, impact, nature. This includes impacting nature massively to produce energy. Every form of energy involves extensive mining of materials, processing of materials, transportation of components, land use, etc. And it includes impacting nature massively to use energy for productive purposes, such as engaging in modern agriculture, building irrigation systems, and building sturdy and resilient buildings. To have as our goal the elimination of human impact is to fundamentally oppose the productive transformation of nature that human life requires. From a human flourishing perspective, we embrace massive pro-human productive impacts on nature, such as building homes, roads, and factories. We want to eliminate or minimize only anti-human, self-destructive impacts on nature, such as pollution or the needless destruction of the most beautiful parts of nature. Massively impacting nature is a crucial part of achieving every human goal, including a healthy environment, which requires fighting many natural forms of waste and pests, and enjoying the outdoors, which requires enough productivity to free up time to enjoy the outdoors and to acquire transportation to the outdoors. The goal of eliminating human impact is thus opposed to every aspect of human life, including the environmental aspects we positively and falsely associate it with. The goal of eliminating human impact, and especially its anti-human nature, are not usually made explicit by our knowledge system, but sometimes they are, especially in the comments made by our designated experts. For example, Bill McKibben, in his landmark book, The End of Nature, writes that our goal should be a humbler world, one where we have less impact on our environment and human happiness would be of secondary importance. What is of primary importance? Eliminating our impact on nature. Though not in our time and not in the time of our children or their children, if we now, today, limited our numbers and our desires and our ambitions, perhaps nature could someday resume its independent working. Thus, nature's independent working comes before human life. A favorable Los Angeles Times review of McKibben's book by biologist David M. Graeber explains some implications of McKibben's position. McKibben is a biocentrist, and so am I. We are not interested in the utility of a particular species or free-flowing river or ecosystem to mankind. They have intrinsic value, more value to me than another human body or a billion of them. Human happiness, and certainly human fecundity, are not as important as a wild and healthy planet. Until such time as Homo sapiens should decide to rejoin nature, some of us can only hope for the right virus to come along. These cases of explicitly naming our primary moral goal as eliminating human impact, and especially of acknowledging its anti-human nature, are relatively rare. If this goal and its anti-human nature were routinely made explicit, it would not be adopted by most people. But it is adopted to a significant degree by most people, and certainly by our knowledge system, in the disguised form of vague, seemingly pro-human terms like going green, minimizing environmental impact, protecting the environment, and saving the planet. These terms seem to imply actions that do not eliminate all types of human impacts, but rather only unnecessary human-harming impacts, such as unnecessary pollution or destruction of natural beauty. But in practice, they absolutely do mean eliminating all types of human impacts, including the vast majority of human impacts that are beneficial to human flourishing. For example, in practice, going green, minimizing environmental impact, protecting the environment, and saving the planet mean objecting to crucial industrial projects, from power plants to dams to apartment complexes, on the grounds that some plant or animal will be affected. Plants and animals that take precedence over the human animals who need or want the projects. Going green, minimizing environmental impact, protecting the environment, and saving the planet means to do less of anything machine-related, from driving to flying to using a washing machine or dryer. These vague goals, which in practice mean eliminating human impact, are constantly used to oppose and stop productive impacts on nature, including, of course, all different forms of cost-effective energy. Note, I will discuss alternative, clear, pro-human environmental terminology at the end of this chapter. The goal of eliminating human impact, whether in clear or disguised form, is demonstrably operating pervasively throughout our knowledge system. For example, outside the realm of energy, our knowledge system is aggressively supporting the goal of eliminating human impact, stopping all manner of impactful activities while ignoring their benefits to human flourishing. This includes opposition to plastics, to logging, to infrastructure development, such as new roads, new buildings, and new factories, which are ever harder to build in much of the world. One particularly horrifying example of our knowledge system's pursuit of this goal has been the widespread elimination of the life-saving, malaria-destroying compound, DDT. According to the politically liberal National Academy of Sciences, this compound has saved 500 million lives from malaria death. But it has been largely eliminated from the poor world by way of pressure from rich nations that were up in arms about reports that DDT has a side effect of thinner bird eggshells. Countless millions of people have died to eliminate our alleged impact on eggshells. Like most such claims, this impact on eggshells claim also proved to be wildly distorted. Once it is clear that our knowledge system is operating on the anti-human moral goal of eliminating human impact, it becomes clear why our knowledge system consistently supports energy elimination policies while ignoring the massive benefits of cost-effective energy. How our knowledge system's anti-impact goal drives it to oppose cost-effective energy. So far, I have explained why our knowledge system's support of energy elimination policies, while ignoring the massive benefits of cost-effective energy to human flourishing, can only be explained by it operating on an anti-human goal and standard, and that the particular anti-human goal and standard it operates on is eliminating human impact on the rest of nature, often disguised as eliminating only the human-harming impacts on the rest of nature, using vague, pro-human-sounding terms like going green, minimizing environmental impact, protecting the environment, and saving the planet. Now let's see in practice how the oft-disguised anti-human goal of eliminating human impact drives our knowledge system's support of energy elimination policies and its seemingly inexplicable ignoring of fossil fuels' benefits to human flourishing. The goal of eliminating human impact on nature inevitably drives three types of opposition to cost-effective energy. Opposition to 1, its development, 2, its side effects, and 3, its use. On the goal of eliminating human impact, the significant impacts of cost-effective energy's development are immoral and in need of elimination. All forms of cost-effective energy involve developing nature, transforming it in a significant way. All forms of energy, as I will discuss in more depth in Chapter 5, involve significantly impacting the Earth by mining or drilling massive swaths and depths of land for raw materials, from coal and oil to the rare earth elements in solar panels and wind turbines, by building massive facilities to process these materials, from oil refineries to rare earth processing facilities, by building massive systems for transporting energy, from oil pipelines to long-distance electric transmission lines, and by building power plants to produce electricity, from natural gas and nuclear power plants to farms of solar panels and wind turbines. Because our knowledge system and many citizens are operating on the goal of eliminating human impact, every development today faces the prospect of at best opposition and at worst elimination. Crucially, even when the mainstream knowledge system doesn't actively support stopping some development, it is highly sympathetic to those who are, because they are seeking to eliminate some form of human impact, which is considered to be the epitome of morality. We see this with the highly successful opposition to solar and wind farms and long-distance transmission lines, which get huge local opposition due to their unusually large impacts. The mainstream knowledge system doesn't usually lead this opposition, but it sanctions it. On the goal of eliminating human impact, the significant impacts of cost-effective energy's side effects are immoral and in need of elimination. Every form of energy has side effects that impact the rest of nature: fossil fuel CO2 emissions, radiation from nuclear, significant waste and animal deaths from solar and wind. Operating on the goal of eliminating human impact, our knowledge system thereby always has a reason for considering any form of energy to be immoral. It is crucial to recognize that if the goal is eliminating human impact, side effects impacting the rest of nature are immoral, even if they are minimally dangerous, benign, or even beneficial to human beings. Consider the issue of rising CO2 levels caused by fossil fuel CO2 emissions, which our knowledge system treats as intrinsically immoral and inherently catastrophic. From a human flourishing perspective, we want to evaluate any negative CO2 side effects of fossil fuels in the context of the massive benefits, including climate mastery benefits, that come with them. But from a human flourishing perspective, we also want to be open to the possibility that these side effects might not be only negative, but also neutral or positive. But on the goal of eliminating human impact, the fact that we have emitted CO2 and increased CO2 levels is intrinsically deeply immoral, regardless of how many benefits to human flourishing come with it, and even if the increased CO2 itself turned out to be a net benefit to human flourishing. For example, in his book, Earth, Bill McKibben argues that it's tragic for human beings to do anything that affects climate, even if it doesn't hurt human beings. Referencing another one of his books, The End of Nature, he writes, "Merely knowing that we'd begun to alter the climate meant that the water flowing in that creek had a different, lesser meaning. Instead of a world where rain had an independent and mysterious existence, the rain had become a subset of human activity," I wrote. "The rain bore a brand. It was a steer, not a deer." This moral damnation of human-impacted rain as a steer, not a deer, means that even if the rainfall became more predictable and positive, it would still be wrong. Indeed, it would be deeply immoral. We can see this view that climate side effects are intrinsically immoral in the widespread assumption that climate change, that is, human climate impact, is all bad, even though we know that the impact involves increasing CO2 levels, which logically and in practice increase plant growth, as well as warmth in a world where many more people die of cold than of heat. We can also see the view that climate side effects are intrinsically immoral in the fact that many in our knowledge system regard it as morally urgent to eliminate CO2 emissions at all costs, even when they themselves do not believe that CO2 emissions are anywhere near the existential threat that some say it is. If you look at most sophisticated people's and institutions' claims about climate impacts, they do not claim anything resembling apocalypse. Instead, they make hedged, modest claims about negative climate impacts, and yet still advocate for the rapid elimination of fossil fuels. For example, President Joe Biden's Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has argued for fossil fuel elimination policies with the claim, "We know warming temperatures might disrupt food and water supplies, leading to unrest around the world." Given what she must know about the massive life-or-death benefits of fossil fuels, including to food and water supplies, that fossil fuel side effects might disrupt food and water supplies doesn't remotely justify the rapid elimination of fossil fuels. She and countless others making similarly incoherent arguments are not engaging in a calculation about the effects of fossil fuels' negative climate impacts on human flourishing compared with fossil fuels' benefits, but rather acting on a morally driven desire to eliminate human climate impact at all costs. The understanding that, on the goal of eliminating human impact, climate side effects are intrinsically immoral is the only way to explain our knowledge system's otherwise inexplicable position that the horrific track record of its environmental predictions and of its designated environmental experts is actually good and even overly conservative. On the goal of advancing human flourishing, This makes no sense. Designated experts predicted mass climate death, and what we got, in large part thanks to fossil fuels, was a massive decrease in climate death. They were totally wrong. But on the goal of eliminating human impact, that doesn't matter. What matters is that human beings impacted climate, which is considered intrinsically and deeply immoral, even if human beings are now far safer from climate. I have focused on how our knowledge system's goal of eliminating human impact drives its aggressive quest to eliminate CO2 emissions and the fossil fuels that cause them, regardless of the consequences for human flourishing, because that is the single biggest energy elimination effort today, and the one on which this book is focused. But it's important to note that the same dynamics apply to other side effects of cost-effective energy. For example, the goal of eliminating human impact drives the aggressive effort to eliminate the side effects of nuclear energy, radiation, and waste by eliminating nuclear energy itself. Even though nuclear side effects are the most masterable, and therefore safe, of any source of energy. How our knowledge system's anti-impact goal drives it to ignore the benefits of cost-effective energy. So far we've seen, 1, how the goal of eliminating human impact drives our knowledge system to regard the significant impacts of cost-effective energy development as immoral and in need of elimination, and 2, how the goal of eliminating human impact drives our knowledge system to regard the significant side effects of cost-effective energy as immoral and in need of elimination. The third way in which cost-effective energy significantly impacts nature and therefore is regarded as intrinsically immoral and in need of elimination is the biggest area of its impact, its use to benefit human beings, which will also explain why our knowledge system ignores the benefits of cost-effective energy. Every benefit we get from using energy involves impacting nature. Consider, what do we do with energy? We use it to power machines that then impact nature in one way or another, from plowing fields to building homes to producing cars. The more cost-effective energy is, the more we will impact nature with more development, more resource use, more consumption, all things that are immoral if our goal is to eliminate human impact. For many of our designated experts, particularly those who most consistently operate on the goal of eliminating human impact, the impact of the benefits of energy on the rest of nature is actually the most significant reason for opposing cost-effective energy, because the benefits of energy cause far more impact than the side effects ever have. If this seems unbelievable, consider an incident several decades ago involving several designated experts and nuclear fusion, a technology that, if it worked, could provide low-cost, on-demand, versatile, global-scale, and ultra-clean energy with no CO2 emissions. In the late 1980s, some inaccurate reports that fusion was close to commercial reality caused some of our designated experts to be asked what they thought about the prospect of an incredibly low-cost and clean form of energy. What did they say? Paul Ehrlich: developing fusion for human beings would be like giving a machine gun to an idiot child. Jeremy Rifkin, another designated environmental expert: it's the worst thing that could happen to our planet. Amory Lovins was already on record as saying, it would be little short of disastrous for us to discover a source of clean, cheap, abundant energy because of what we might do with it. They were talking here about a technology that could possibly have brought the miracle of machine labor to everyone in the world with virtually no negative side effects on human flourishing. And to them, that was a bad thing because it would involve impacting the Earth so much. That's the anti-humanism of seeking to eliminate human impact. When designated experts talk about present and future catastrophe, they are often evaluating increases in human flourishing as morally catastrophic. Take the head of the UN's claim that our war on nature has left the planet broken. What he means is not that the planet is broken by a human flourishing standard, but that it is broken because we have impacted the planet a lot. largely through the benefits of energy use, and that is a moral catastrophe, even though we are flourishing as never before. Most of our knowledge system and most of us are not consistently enough operating on the goal of eliminating human impact to view the benefits of energy use to human flourishing as immoral. However, because eliminating human impact is in practice our knowledge system's primary moral goal, our knowledge system consistently treats the benefits of energy use to human flourishing as morally irrelevant, and most of us accept this. Observe that our knowledge system, as well as our culture, has infinitely more interest in the fate of polar bear habitats than it has in 3 billion people without energy. Now, in my experience, when I point out the importance of energy and the desperate need for it, most people care a lot. But absent someone pointing these things out, because our knowledge system operates on the goal of eliminating human impact, most people don't even think about human considerations. The goal we are operating on determines what we focus on and what we don't focus on, what we are looking at and thinking about, and what is out of sight, out of mind. When our goal is eliminating human impact, usually in the form of going green, minimizing environmental impact, protecting the environment, or saving the planet, the value of energy to human flourishing, and even human flourishing as such, is barely considered. We now understand why our knowledge system consistently supports the elimination of cost-effective energy while ignoring its massive benefits, and why we go along with it. Our knowledge system is operating on the anti-human goal of eliminating human impact, which leads it to regard the inherently high-impact phenomenon of cost-effective energy as immoral and in need of elimination, and which causes it to regard cost-effective energy's massive benefits to human flourishing as irrelevant at best and immoral at worst. What about our knowledge system's consistent catastrophizing of the side effects of cost-effective energy? This, too, is related to an anti-human impact idea. The idea that significant human impact is inevitably self-destructive. How our knowledge system's delicate nurture assumption drives it to catastrophize the side effects of cost-effective energy. What explains our knowledge system's consistent catastrophizing of the side effects of cost-effective energy? Recall that catastrophizing involves falsely predicting an imminent catastrophe from cost-effective energy side effects by 1. Dramatically over-predicting those negative side effects, and 2. Ignoring human beings' ability, fueled by cost-effective energy, to master those side effects. Our knowledge system's catastrophizing has been so bad that it has routinely predicted catastrophes from fossil fuel side effects in areas that fossil fuels have actually improved: safety from climate, resource availability, and environmental quality. Whenever we see consistently false predictions by smart people, we can be confident that a major cause is false assumptions. An assumption is a premise, a part of a reasoning process, that one is not actively validating, but taking for granted. For example, in this book, I have been assuming premises such as human beings are mortal, hurricanes can be deadly, and food is necessary for survival. When I use the term assumption in this book, I am specifically talking about assumptions about cause and effect, how the world works. Assumptions are powerful because they shape our expectations and predictions. Every expectation and prediction involves assumptions about cause and effect, and false expectations or predictions are always based on false assumptions. For example, false predictions about oil running out in the 1980s, 1990s, or 2000s were based on the false assumptions that A, the Earth has relatively little oil in it, and or B, that human beings would not develop new, more cost-effective ways to produce oil. An effective way of identifying false assumptions behind predictions is to ask, what expectations are at work in these predictions, and what false assumptions are behind those expectations? Looking at the catastrophizing predictions of fossil-fueled climate catastrophe warming or cooling, pollution catastrophe, and depletion catastrophe, we can see two expectations in common. One, some side effect is, on its own, going to have an extremely negative impact on our environment. And two, human beings will be unable to adapt to, let alone master, that impact. For example, on climate, rising CO2 levels will not merely cause some warming impact that we could likely master or at least cope with, they will cause rapid, out-of-control warming that will overwhelm and destroy us. On pollution, emitting particles into the air by burning fossil fuels is not merely an undesirable side effect that could be minimized, it is so massive and so out of control that it will significantly block out the sun. On depletion, oil is not merely a finite raw material that could be exhausted in some distant future, giving us plenty of time to develop alternatives. It is so scarce that we'll soon be unable to produce more of it no matter what we do. Why does our knowledge system always expect extreme negative impacts from cost-effective energy side effects and always expect that we will be unable to master those impacts? Because of a false assumption that leads anyone holding it to expect that all forms of significant impact on nature will inevitably be self-destructive. I call this the delicate nurturer assumption. The delicate nurturer assumption is the assumption that Earth, absent human impact, exists in an optimal, nurturing, delicate balance that is as stable, sufficient, and safe as we can hope to expect. The delicate nurturer assumption is everywhere in our knowledge system, from elite universities to popular movies. One popular form of the delicate nurturer assumption among designated experts has been the I equals PAT framework for evaluating our impacts on nature, popularized by Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren. I equals PAT is shorthand for environmental impact equals population times affluence times technology. As Wikipedia summarizes it, the variable I in the I equals PAT equation represents environmental impact. The environment may be viewed as a self-regenerating system that can endure a certain level of impact. The maximum endurable impact is called the carrying capacity. The idea is that Earth can handle only a certain low level of our impact, its carrying capacity, beyond which point it will be unable to support us. Or take the wildly popular movie The Lion King. One of the movie's heroes, Mufasa, the king of the lions and therefore of all creatures, tells his son Simba, the future Lion King, "Everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. As king, you need to understand that balance and respect all the creatures, from the crawling ant to the leaping antelope." One of the main plot lines of the movie is that Scar, Mufasa's evil brother, kills Mufasa and takes over, with Scar's hyena henchmen consuming as much as they can. The delicate balance is broken, and the savanna is barren, no longer nurturing the creatures that once flourished in harmony. The expectation that follows from the delicate nurture assumption is that if we try to improve our lot by significantly impacting the planet, like by empowering ourselves with mass fossil fuel use, it will inevitably destroy that balance and us along with it. A key aspect of the delicate nurturer assumption is the incredibly negative view of human beings that it implies, which I call the parasite polluter assumption. Humans' essential impact on our environment is to parasitically plunder our environment of resources and to pollute it to make it unsafe and unhealthy. On this view, human beings are certainly incapable of mastering the allegedly extremely negative environmental impacts we cause, so once we destroy the alleged delicate balance, we're screwed. Because the delicate nurturer assumption is so prevalent, it is extremely rare in my experience to meet people who are not substantially operating on it, which is why it's so common for us to feel that catastrophe predictions must be right. But the delicate nurturer assumption is false, which is why it leads to wrong, often 180 degrees wrong, predictions. The earth is not a naturally nurturing, delicate balance, but rather a naturally one, dynamic, two, deficient, and three, dangerous place that we must massively impact if we are to survive and flourish. One, dynamic. Our natural environment, including climate, is a highly dynamic system, even if we have zero impact. This is why human life was ruled by natural changes in conditions, such as changes from plentiful rainfall to drought, for millennia. Two, deficient. From the perspective of human flourishing, human beings living long, healthy, opportunity-filled lives, the planet is not naturally sufficient. It is deficient. That's why the historical life expectancy was under 30. 3. Dangerous. Our natural environment is dangerous. We are naturally threatened by organisms that are deliberately trying to destroy us, from large predators to small parasites. We are also naturally threatened by inanimate factors, such as the dangerous climate and weather conditions that exist everywhere around the globe. My term for the reality of the relationship between Earth and human beings is the wild potential premise. The potential in wild potential refers to the fact that Earth has the potential to be a highly livable place if we impact it positively enough. To be sure, human impact is not necessarily positive. Unintelligent, destructive human impact can make our world worse. For example, we can overfish or pollute a lake and then lose some or all of the value we were gaining from it. But the purpose and fundamental role of human impact throughout history is to make Earth a better place to live through intelligent, productive impact. The history of fossil fuels shows example after example of productive human impacts. Human beings have used fossil-fueled machines to transform nature into values that nourish us, abundant food and clean water, and that neutralize nature's many dangers, such as irrigation systems neutralizing massive drought danger. This history refutes the falsehood that human beings are essentially parasite polluters and reveals that we are producer improvers who make the planet a far more nourishing and safe place to live in a wide variety of environments and can dynamically do so in new ways as conditions change. The pervasive acceptance of the delicate nurture assumption, including the parasite polluter assumption, explains much of our knowledge system's catastrophizing of the side effects of cost-effective energy, and our acceptance of this catastrophizing. Insofar as our knowledge system operates on the delicate nurture assumption, it will catastrophize. And insofar as we operate on the delicate nurture assumption, we will elevate catastrophizers and expect them to be right, no matter how many times they have been wrong. This is a major reason why the catastrophizing designated environmental experts keep rising in stature as they keep making 180-degree wrong predictions and horrifically deadly prescriptions. But why is the delicate nurture assumption so prevalent if it's so wrong and so contradicted by history? In particular, why is it so prevalent among designated experts who definitely should know better? I believe the answer is that the delicate nurture assumption is a way for anti-human designated experts to disguise their anti-human goals to both pro-human audiences and to themselves. I say they seek to disguise their anti-human goals to others because there is no way that designated experts can believe in the version of the delicate nurture assumption that has been spread throughout our knowledge system. It is plausible to me that many designated experts believe, with some sincerity, in the delicate part of delicate nurture, that there's some delicate balance that could, with enough human impact, collapse. But even if they believe that unimpacted nature is the most nurturing possible environment in the long run, they know full well that by the modern standard of living, it's a barely livable place. They know that the life expectancy for the average human being used to be 30, and now it is over 70. They know that climate danger used to be a menace to human life that those of us in the empowered world cannot imagine today. And yet they still promote the delicate nurture assumption incessantly, including the climate version that regards the climate, the unimpacted climate, as a friendly force. This is dishonest, but it is highly effective at advancing anti-impact, anti-human energy elimination policies, including fossil fuel elimination, to a pro-human audience. Anti-human designated experts know that the more that pro-human people believe that Earth is a delicate nurturer, the more they will fear some sort of catastrophe in the future from their high-impact, fossil-fueled way of life, and the more open they'll be to anti-impact policies such as fossil fuel elimination. In fact, pro-human people on the delicate nurturer assumption will actually expect that energy elimination policies will, by making the world more natural, be good for them, even if, in reality, they will be horrifically bad for them. I also believe that our designated experts cling to the delicate nurturer assumption to disguise their anti-human goal to themselves. Very few human beings can admit to themselves that they are fundamentally anti-human, even if their whole lives are devoted to stopping the high-impact productive activities that make human flourishing possible. The more one clings to the belief that Earth is delicate and that we're always one impact away from collapse, the more one can convince oneself, I don't hate and want to destroy humans, I just want to save human beings from themselves. Whatever the exact motives of our designated expert spreading of the delicate nurturer assumption are, however, two things are certain. One, this assumption is fundamentally false, and two, it drives our knowledge system's consistent catastrophizing of cost-effective energy side effects and our acceptance of this catastrophizing. Replacing the anti-impact framework with the human flourishing framework. We now know the answer to the two crucial questions that we needed to answer to understand what is causing our knowledge system and to a significant extent ourselves to engage in brazenly irrational methods of evaluation when it comes to cost-effective energy. 1. Why does our knowledge system support the elimination of fossil fuels and other forms of cost-effective energy while ignoring their benefits? Because our knowledge system operates on the anti-human, anti-energy goal and standard of eliminating human impact, often disguised through vague environmental terminology that causes it to seek to eliminate the inherently high-impact phenomenon of cost-effective energy and regard its benefits as at best irrelevant and at worst immoral. 2. Why does our knowledge system catastrophize the side effects of cost-effective energy? Because our knowledge system operates on the anti-human, anti-energy assumption that Earth is a delicate nurturer that significant human impact inevitably destroys, and therefore that cost-effective energy's significant impacts will inevitably be self-destructive. The anti-human goal of eliminating human impact, the vague environmental terminology that often disguises it, the anti-impact delicate nurturer assumption, and the methods of ignoring benefits and catastrophizing side effects drive together to constitute a philosophical framework that shapes how our knowledge system, and to a significant extent the rest of us, evaluate what to do about fossil fuels and any other issue that involves significant impact on nature. A framework is a starting structure. Just as a complex man-made construction, like a skyscraper, is shaped by its starting structure, so our thoughts and actions are shaped by some starting structure of ideas. Crucially, this structure is often largely implicit, unstated, and unidentified, which is certainly the case for the anti-impact framework. The anti-impact framework drives our knowledge system, and to a large extent the rest of us, to pursue the elimination of human impact at human expense via energy elimination policies without realizing it. When our knowledge system encounters any high-impact phenomenon, such as any form of cost-effective energy, the anti-impact framework will drive our knowledge system to regard the phenomenon as intrinsically immoral and inevitably self-destructive, and thus in need of elimination, no matter how beneficial it is to human beings, and no matter how masterable its negative side effects are. For example, in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, even though the evidence was that continuing expanding fossil fuel use would be massively beneficial to human beings, our designated environmental experts, based on the anti-impact framework, evaluated fossil fuel use as an evil to be eliminated and predicted that pursuing that evil would lead to humanity's imminent self-destruction. Since the anti-impact framework is no longer relegated to designated environmental experts, but is now universal, our knowledge system is guaranteed to advocate for and pursue the elimination of fossil fuels, even if the pro-human policy would be a dramatic increase in fossil fuel use. The anti-impact framework is therefore an urgent threat. And because the threat involves depriving us of a proper evaluation of what to do about fossil fuels, it is a threat that prevents us from knowing what policy to advocate instead of the likely catastrophic policy of fossil fuel elimination. Knowing that our knowledge system's operating framework is completely wrong does not tell us what's right about fossil fuels going forward. In particular, it does not tell us what's true about the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels going forward, as well as the availability of future alternatives to fossil fuels that could hypothetically give us the benefits of fossil fuels without the CO2 side effects. We just know that whatever the truth is, our knowledge system can be trusted to give us something very different and dangerous. While knowing that our knowledge system's operating framework is completely wrong does not tell us what's right, it points us to what is needed to know what's right. We need to explicitly identify a valid, pro-human, alternative framework that will enable us to properly evaluate fossil fuels, including, crucially, to find genuine experts who are not irreparably distorted by the anti-impact framework. What is that valid, pro-human alternative framework? I believe there are four essential elements, which together I call the human flourishing framework: the moral goal and standard of human flourishing, pro-human environmental terminology, the wild potential premise, and the method of full context evaluation. The goal: human flourishing. The fundamental principle of the human flourishing framework is that advancing human flourishing should be our primary moral goal and therefore our standard of evaluation. When we evaluate continuing fossil fuel use, including both its benefits and its side effects, our standard should be advancing human flourishing. Advancing human flourishing is a long-term and wide-ranging goal. It doesn't just mean thinking about the next year. It means thinking generations ahead. And it doesn't mean indifference to a safe, healthy, beautiful environment. It means placing high value on those. On the goal of advancing human flourishing, the anti-human goal of eliminating human impact is immoral. While we want to eliminate certain anti-human impacts, our overall attitude toward impacting the rest of nature is positive, because massive impact, done intelligently and productively, is essential to our survival and flourishing. Pro-human environmental terminology. A crucial part of pursuing the goal of advancing human flourishing is thinking clearly about our relationship to our environment. As I have discussed, conventional vague environmental terms, such as going green, minimizing environmental impact, protecting the environment, and saving the planet, create confusion and disguise the anti-human idea of eliminating human impact as the pro-human idea of eliminating unnecessary human-harming impacts, such as unnecessary pollution and unnecessary destruction of natural beauty. This has been disastrous. To think about energy and other issues in terms of human flourishing, we need clear, pro-human environmental terminology. In this regard, I advocate using the phrase improving our environment instead of saving/protecting the environment, and our world or improving our world instead of saving/protecting the planet. The environment and the planet, while they superficially sound like they are pro-human terms, in practice refer to the anti-human ideas of the unimpacted environment or the unimpacted planet. Whereas if we talk about our environment or more broadly, our world, it captures that we are thinking about our surroundings from a human-centered perspective, as a human environment. And when we are thinking about our environment and our world, the main term we use is not saving or protecting, since we recognize that these things are naturally deficient and dangerous, but rather improving, which requires massive, intelligent, productive impact. Operating on the goal of advancing human flourishing using pro-human environmental terminology causes us to value anything in our environment that is good for us, regardless of whether we impacted it or not. We value oxygen in the air, a beautiful waterfall, the majesty of the Pacific Ocean, and we value farms, skyscrapers, and roads. They are all our environment and our world. And we also devalue anything that is not good for us, regardless of whether we impacted it or not. We devalue nature's many poisons and predators, its many climate dangers, as well as reasonably preventable pollution, danger, and destruction of natural beauty. While anti-impact thinkers like to portray a pro-human approach to our environment as adversarial or hostile to the rest of nature, in reality, a pro-human approach to our environment means having a pro-human relationship with the rest of nature, one that is optimized for human beings. Sometimes, as in the case of malarial mosquitoes, that means seeking the destruction of other living things. Sometimes, as in the case of polar bears, it means isolating other living things so we can witness their majesty while protecting ourselves from their danger. Sometimes, as in the case of a beloved pet, it means investing resources to give them an unnaturally high chance of surviving and flourishing. Contrast this to the anti-impact framework, which guarantees an anti-human relationship with the rest of nature. The anti-impact framework glorifies and seeks to preserve anti-human parts of nature, malarial mosquitoes, water naturally contaminated by animals, disease-breeding swamps, as the environment, or the planet, making the world a more dangerous human environment. And it glorifies and seeks to preserve all the parts of nature we need to transformatively impact via development to survive and flourish, such as the underground minerals, forests, and rivers anti-impact forces are perpetually trying to save from human impact. If we pursue the environmental goal, not of protecting the environment or saving the planet from human beings, but of improving our environment or improving our world for human beings, we can have it all. The best of what exists naturally and the best of what we can create, including the time and ability to enjoy what exists naturally. And we can think clearly about all the effects of fossil fuels on our world, both beneficial effects and negative side effects, from a human flourishing perspective. The wild potential premise. A key element of evaluating what to do about fossil fuels and anything else that involves significant impact on the rest of nature is our causal understanding of the relationship between human beings and the rest of nature. The core causal principle of the human flourishing framework is the wild potential premise, which recognizes that the Earth, in its unimpacted state, is dynamic, deficient, and dangerous, and requires massive, intelligent, productive impact by human beings. The wild potential premise includes the producer-improver premise, the recognition that human beings are capable of producing new value, not just consuming value, and of improving the safety and cleanliness of our environment, not just negatively impacting it. And we are capable of doing these things dynamically, adapting to changing conditions. On the wild potential premise, we can accurately evaluate the benefits and side effects of continuing fossil fuel use on human flourishing because we will be informed by a basic understanding of how the world actually works, versus being led to catastrophizing by the delicate nurture assumption's fundamentally false view of how the world works. full context evaluation. The anti-impact framework drives our knowledge system to use brazenly irrational methods of evaluation, ignore the benefits of cost-effective energy to human flourishing, and catastrophize its side effects. The human flourishing framework makes possible a pro-human, rational method of evaluation, full context evaluation. Full context evaluation means considering all the relevant factors, relevant from a human flourishing perspective, informed by the wild potential premise. In the context of energy, a full context evaluation requires carefully considering and weighing the benefits and side effects of different forms of energy in relation to human flourishing, neither ignoring nor catastrophizing anything. I believe that the human flourishing framework is the basis for reforming the mainstream knowledge system and, crucial to the focus of this book, key to resolving the existential question of what to do about fossil fuels. If we are to learn what is actually the right policy toward fossil fuels going forward, which requires answering crucial questions such as what rising CO2 levels will do and what the availability of alternatives will be, we need to employ the human flourishing framework and, when seeking out expert knowledge, reject experts and sources operating on the anti-impact framework and find those who are operating on a better pro-human framework. Let me illustrate how different and superior the human flourishing framework is to the anti-impact framework by showing how these frameworks apply to the central concern around fossil fuels, their CO2 emissions. The human flourishing framework versus the anti-impact framework on CO2 emissions. What should be done about fossil fuels' CO2 emissions going forward? It totally depends on our framework. Using the human flourishing framework, a full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use's side effect of CO2 emissions requires the following. 1. Being open to negative and positive impacts of CO2 emissions. Positive impacts might include the benefits of more plant food in the atmosphere and the benefits of more warmth in dangerously cold places. 2. Evaluating any negative impacts in the context of the climate mastery benefits that come with them. For example, if rising CO2 levels make storms 10% stronger, how does that compare with the increased storm mastery abilities that will come with continuing or expanding fossil fuel use? Other examples include the ability of fossil-fueled irrigation to alleviate the effects of drought, or the ability of fossil-fueled air conditioning to alleviate the effects of hot weather. 3. Evaluating the climate-related effects of fossil fuels in the context of their benefits to every other area of life. This is how to evaluate CO2 emissions on the human flourishing framework, regardless of what the facts turn out to be. If rising CO2 levels turn out to have some catastrophic, overwhelming climate impacts, the human flourishing framework will recognize that and factor that in. If their climate impacts are positive, neutral, or negative but masterable, the human flourishing framework will recognize that and factor it in. Contrast the human flourishing framework's method of evaluating CO2 emissions with what we see the mainstream knowledge system on the anti-impact framework do all the time. 1. On the goal of eliminating human impact, it evaluates CO2 emissions as intrinsically immoral, and on the delicate nurturer assumption, assumes they will be inevitably self-destructive. Almost no one even thinks about the fact that CO2 is plant food, so rising CO2 levels could have huge greening benefits, nor about the fact that warming is desired in most of the world, even with our 1 degree of warming over the last 170 years of fossil fuel use. Cold-related deaths are still many times that of heat-related deaths. 2. It ignores or denies any climate mastery benefits of fossil fuels, despite fossil fuels' major contribution to our unprecedented safety from climate. 3. It ignores or denies virtually all benefits of fossil fuels. On the anti-impact framework, our knowledge system is so bent on eliminating impact, especially climate impact, so catastrophizing of fossil fuel CO2 emissions, and so disinterested in the massive life or death benefits that come with them, that the number one explicit moral goal in the world today is eliminating our impact on climate, usually under the heading of net zero or carbon neutrality. Governments, companies, universities, and newspapers are all righteously committed to this goal. They think, due to vague environmental terminology such as saving the climate or saving the planet, that they are pursuing an improvement in human life by pursuing a more livable climate. But in reality, they cannot be pursuing an improvement in human life because they are monomaniacally focused just on climate, with a cruel indifference to the billions who desperately need energy and the billions who could lose it with net zero policies. And even within climate, they are not focused on its livability, which would mean a huge focus on cost-effective energy to protect us from the naturally dangerous climate, but on eliminating our impact on climate. The idea that this anti-human approach is pro-human is reinforced by the delicate nurture assumption, which teaches us to think of the climate as a stable, sufficient, and safe delicate nurturer to be left unimpacted, rather than a dynamic, deficient, and dangerous wild potential that must be mastered through massive, intelligent human impact on nature. No matter what the actual impacts of CO2 emissions on human flourishing are, our knowledge system's anti-impact framework will cause it to seek to eliminate the form of energy that causes them, ignoring the benefits and catastrophizing the side effects of CO2 emissions, just as our designated experts have done with the side effects of cost-effective energy, including nuclear energy, for the last 50 years. On the issue of CO2, as well as every other aspect of evaluating the world's massive use of fossil fuels going forward, the human flourishing framework gives us a crucial tool for evaluating experts. No matter how much factual knowledge someone has, if they are on the anti-impact framework, they will distort our evaluation of fossil fuel CO2 emissions or any of their other effects. Thus, we should seek out those who are, as much as possible, on the human flourishing framework and minimally distorted by the anti-impact framework. For example, if an expert engages both the potential benefits and side effects of continuing fossil fuel use, we have reason to think they are on something close to the human flourishing framework. By contrast, if, like so many designated experts, they focus only on side effects and make extreme negative claims about the future that don't factor in our ability to master our environment, we know they are on some version of the anti-impact framework. My project. Not too long after I began studying energy 14 years ago, I came to three conclusions that I hope you now agree with. 1. Because cost-effective energy is so important and so desperately needed, what to do about fossil fuels going forward is one of the most important decisions of our lifetime. 2. Because the mainstream knowledge system is on the anti-impact framework, it is guaranteed to give us terrible anti-human guidance, and its prescription of rapidly eliminating fossil fuels could well be catastrophically bad. 3. Some source or person needs to give us a full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use using the human flourishing framework, synthesizing the best relevant research, including the latest evidence about potential alternatives to fossil fuels and the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels. My ideal was to find some general expert who had given the general public the full context evaluation I was looking for. I concluded that no one had done this and that it was difficult to do because most specialists in the relevant topics, energy, economics, environmental science, climate science, are substantially, if not overwhelmingly, operating on the anti-impact framework. For example, even among energy experts who oppose policies to rapidly eliminate fossil fuels, many accept net zero as a moral goal and talk little about the value of cost-effective energy and the desperate need of billions of people for more of it. Because the issue of energy in general, and fossil fuels in particular, is so saturated by the anti-impact framework, I thought I could do a lot of good as a philosopher on the human flourishing framework with enough of a technical background and aptitude that I could grasp the relevant technical, economic, and scientific issues involved. So I decided to become a general expert on fossil fuels myself, drawing on knowledge from the best sources and specialists I could find, including experts on energy technology, economics, environmental health and safety, climate, and human adaptation/mastery. One of the challenges of performing a full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use was that I myself had been immersed in the mainstream knowledge system my whole life, and therefore had been immersed in the anti-impact framework. On many occasions, I have found myself inadvertently operating on the anti-impact framework, which is one reason why I've repeatedly consulted pro-human philosophers to help make sure I'm consistently applying the human flourishing framework. This book is my synthesis of everything that I've learned. At the outset of this book, it likely seemed like I was going to argue for the radical conclusion that humanity should use more fossil fuels by claiming that most experts are totally wrong about the subjects relevant to evaluating fossil fuels, such as energy economics, environmental science, and climate science, and that I have revolutionary new expertise on all these subjects. I hope you now see that this is not the case at all. Instead, this book's radical conclusion is overwhelmingly the result of the framework I am operating on, the human flourishing framework, which causes me to evaluate fossil fuels in a completely different way than our anti-impact mainstream knowledge system. Additionally, unlike much of our knowledge system, I will do my best to accurately convey what most experts think on relevant subjects and why, instead of misrepresenting experts' views to advance my policies, as governments routinely misrepresent the UN IPCC to support fossil fuel elimination policies. For the remainder of this book, I will do my best to give you a full context evaluation of continuing fossil fuel use, benefits and side effects from a human flourishing perspective with as much precision as possible. In part two, I will assess the full benefits of continuing the world's massive fossil fuel use, including the future ability of fossil fuels versus alternatives to provide cost-effective energy for the billions who currently have energy and for the billions who don't. In part three, I will assess the main side effects of continuing fossil fuel use, focusing on the side effect of greatest concern, CO2. Unlike our knowledge system, I will not assume that rising CO2 is intrinsically immoral and inevitably self-destructive. I will assess its impacts from a human flourishing perspective, integrating them with fossil fuels benefits, including its almost universally ignored climate mastery benefits. Based on this full context evaluation, in part four, I will map out what energy policies will most advance human flourishing and share proven strategies for how we can persuade others to adopt these policies. Let's get started.